For more than 30 years, Lori Moore has been known for her smart, funny, luminous fiction. Her latest book, See What Can Be Done, Essays, Criticism, and Commentary, is a departure in terms of genre, but her piercing insights, subtle wit, and deep humanity are evident throughout. This book is published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I am so happy it brings Lori Moore to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So, tell me, how did you begin with nonfiction? We know you so well for fiction. Where did the nonfiction come from?
Well, the nonfiction has been an ongoing thing for about 35 years. So, I've had all these nonfiction pieces that I've done both on assignment and sometimes just voluntarily. And I decided to put them all together because it was like this other life that I'd been having.
This other life, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought, well, let's get this other life between covers.
Was your first invitation to do this sort of nonfiction work from the New York Times Review of Book section?
Well, the very first piece in the book is actually from Cornell's literary magazine, mm-hmm. which is called Epic. But then after that, it was from the New York Times Book Review. Mm-hmm. Anatole Broillard was the first person to call me mm-hmm. when I was out in Wisconsin to say, would you like to review for us? And then, you know, flash forward about 15 years, I was writing for the New York Review of Books, mostly.
Do you remember the very first book you reviewed?
For the New York Review?
Yeah.
Yes, it was the Joyce Carol Oates novel.
Uh-huh, it was the Joyce Carol Oates, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what was that like? Was it sort of venturing into that world?
It was a little scary.
Uh-huh.
Scary but fun. I had much more space than I was used to having in the New York Times. They just don't have as much space. So I had twice as much space. I had this major writer to write about. And I got to sort of stick in little snippets of personal essay while I discussed the book as well. So my son is actually quoted in that review of Joyce Carol Oates' novel.
Were you assigned that book or did you choose that one?
No, Barbara Epstein assigned me that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about where the title come from. I think this is a great story.
The title is See What Can Be Done. And that is how Bob Silvers at the New York Review used to sign his notes, mm-hmm. both his written notes and his emails. Mm-hmm. And not just with me, but with a lot of people, he would just send you something. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, he would say, you know, see what can be done. Mm-hmm. You know, he would say, I think you might be right for this. I think you might, you know, like to write something on this. We'd love a piece on this. See what can be done.
I every time I say that title or sort of see it again, I think about how to say it because of the comment you make early on that it's not a sort of a comment on the work, but a invitation to inquisition, right? To
right, yeah. It's not a boast,
yeah,
but it does have that ambiguity, I suppose, to it. Yeah.
But and I think as a prompt, it is such a powerful one. It's such a sort of positive one, and one that sort of makes one feel empowered.
Yeah, it was an invitation. But also a bit of an instruction. Mm-hmm. And it was just his way. He just always found the right tone mm-hmm. to sort of present something to you. So,
and was it at Silver's request, insistence, that you started writing for the New York Review of Books?
I actually first started with Barbara Epstein.
Okay.
And then after she passed away, then I started working with Bob.
So what kind of when was it that you first started and how many pieces do you do for them a year?
I don't know. It depended. I mean, sometimes I would do a handful and then other times I would maybe only do one. It depended on whether I was working on a book mm-hmm. in a really, you know, concentrated way and whether or not I felt I had time for this side project, because it involves a lot of intense concentration to write a book review, to write a movie review. You're reading background books to mm-hmm. go with the, you know, the central book.
Bigger context.
Yeah, yeah. You're contextualizing it and situating it in an author or a filmmaker's work. And so it just depended on my time and energy. Mm-hmm.
And I have to back up because I realized I skipped over a very important question. Did you ask your son's permission before you quoted him in Joyce Carol Oates?
Well, I think he was only four. Oh. So I really...
Even still, come on.
I don't think I did.
What was it that he offered you that was so good to quote in the review?
Well,
do you remember?
He was talking about stars. Mm-hmm. He was talking about stars and where stars are located. And so I used that as an entry point to talk about charisma, fame, mm-hmm. stars in the other sense of things, but how scattered and strangely located mm-hmm. Charismatic people can be.
Fantastic. What's the spread between the books that you're able to pick for yourself and the ones that come your way? Is it sort of a 50-50, or are you able to choose most of the books these days that you want to review?
It's probably... That's an interesting question. Well, right now, the New York Review has a new editor,
yeah.
Ian Baruma.
We had on the show just a few weeks ago. Yeah,
Oh. I did ask him to review. I wanted to review something. He wanted me to review one thing. And I thought, oh, I'm so busy. But what I really would love to review is this other thing. And he said, oh, we've already assigned that other thing. So right now, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm also yeah. working on a novel, so I want to stay concentrated on that.
Keeping yourself busy.
Yeah.
You have a friend who told you he was relieved when he saw your name as a contributor on the list of contents for the publication because he knew that there would be at least one article he'd be able to understand. Was that meant to be a compliment? I assume it might have been.
No? Not really.
Oh.
No, he was always reading the New York Review to sort of educate himself and feel smarter. And then suddenly, when I was in there, he knew it was not going to be a challenge. But I took it as a compliment. I took it as a sign that he knew that I would be speaking plainly mm-hmm. and in an ordinary fashion and not in some highfalutin, mm-hmm. you know, esoteric way.
I think that is one of your strengths because, particularly on this nonfiction side, because when you writers like Joan Didion or James Baldwin that have amazing intelligence and are bringing really nuanced, subtle ideas to the page, do so in plain language that is accessible. And I think you succeed in doing that here with so many of these pieces. Did you collect this collection? Is more or less a sort of product of your day job, we could say, right? If nonfiction and reviewing is sort of what you do, how do you manage your identity in terms of your fiction work and your nonfiction work?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mentioned in the introduction that at one point in the late 80s, I was introduced to someone at a party and they said, oh, I know you. You review books. And it hurt my feelings because I also write books, but I wasn't known as that yet. So I thought, maybe I'm reviewing too many books. But, you know, in the last year or two when we decided to put this book together, I became sort of proud of the fact that I'd managed to do, you know, 35 years of all of this. So
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Lori Moore about her new book, See What Can Be Done, Essays, Criticism, and Commentary, out with Alfred A. Knopf. So what's the difference in terms of process and emotional commitment between writing fiction and writing nonfiction, like these pieces collected here?
Yeah, that's also a good question. With fiction, obviously, you have to invent the world. You have to invent a world and then kind of, you know, dramatize it and then have a conversation within it. The nonfiction is slightly easier, mm-hmm. but it's also a little more dangerous. It's easier in that the world that you're discussing is already there. Mm-hmm. You're just responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little more dangerous because the world you're responding to is created by someone else,
mm-hmm.
a film, mm-hmm. a play. And you might be stepping on some toes. With mm-hmm. fiction, you have the amnesty of its being fiction, and there are no toes to step on because they're all fictional toes.
All your own creation.
Right.
So how did you make the selections for this book?
It's a combination of assignments and, mm-hmm. and things that I did voluntarily. I did leave some things out. I guess that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I did leave some things out because some things were just, I don't know. I put in all the New York Review pieces.
Uh-huh.
I did not put in all the New York Times pieces.
You said that you thought writing nonfiction was, you know, more dangerous than fiction. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You said something about it, but I think it might catch some people unawares. A lot of people are intimidated by the idea of invention and starting at, you know, square one.
Oh, invention is fun and safe, and you can live dangerously but also safely within fiction. In nonfiction, you're putting forth your opinions about something someone else has worked very, very hard on. Mm-hmm. And you may be working very hard on putting forth your opinions in as intelligent a way as possible, but you can offend some people.
You also said that nonfiction writing is more autobiographical than fiction. How so?
Well, I don't know if it's more, but it can be as autobiographical. I think you have to know yourself very well to write a personal essay. I think you have to know your mind fairly well to write a critical essay or a review.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever felt that you've been given unfair reviews? Or, never. 30 years, never one fair unfair review.
Oh, writers always feel that.
What's your relationship? I mean, to others' responses to your work? How much do you engage it?
I don't engage it. I'm not one of these writers who refuses to read the reviews. I feel that stance is just kind of cowardly and just not strong in the face of a general cultural conversation. And because I write reviews, I am interested in how other people would review. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't read every single review of my work, but I will read, you know, ones that I'm directed to. If someone says, oh, you should take a look at the Wall Street Journal, you know, I'll take a look at it. And I am interested in how someone else goes about the business of reviewing. This doesn't mean that it all pleases you, but it's often interesting. And I'm not going to be vulnerable to it. I said last week, in a way that I probably shouldn't have, I said, oh, writers who don't read their reviews are just lying little babies.
Probably definitely lying. Maybe babies.
And I think they are lying. And maybe they're babies, I don't know. But I was trying to be a little tough.
Yeah. Have you ever had the experience of reading a review of your work and it somehow shedding some light on your work, if that makes any sense?
Very seldom. Most writers will tell you that it's very seldom that happens.
Yeah.
But once in a while it does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always even in a good review. Sometimes it's in a bad review.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Sometimes you'll go, this is a really bad review, but I understand why this paragraph is here.
Yeah. I also think that sometimes, you know, readers make connections or see connective tissue between things that a writer might not, and sometimes that's just
absolutely
part of the artistic experience, I think.
Yep. Yes, that has happened too. Yeah.
When an author is invited to review a particular book, it's often because the book is similar to the kind of books that they themselves have written. That's always struck me as a little bit tricky in cutting both ways. Do you think that there's any potential of conflict there, or do you think that that's sort of a smart way for publications to approach reviews, to find writers who are writing on similar topics or similar themes?
I think different publications do it in different ways. I think the New York Review has often liked to find unexpected reviewers, someone you wouldn't expect to review this particular thing. And so that's fun. I think reviewers like that. They may initially balk a little. They may say, oh, I'm not the right person for this. When I was presented the Clarice Lispector book, I thought, I know nothing about Clarice Lispector. This isn't going to work. I don't read Portuguese. I know nothing about Brazilian literature. But it turned out to be a wonderful experience, so I'm really glad I did it.
And that experience of discovery comes across in what you wrote. You know, you had the sense of someone coming to it new in the sense of discovery.
Right. I included that as part of the review.
What do you think a writer brings to a book review that a critic might not?
That's also an excellent question.
Thank you.
Well, I think they're looking at the problem of storytelling. They're also looking at the sentences themselves, the prose. They're looking at when the prose succeeds and when it fails. And if you're looking at screen narrative, you're often looking at what screen narrative can do that written narrative cannot, and vice versa. And that's a very interesting thing to note. where novels are actually have the edge on mm-hmm. on film and mm-hmm. television.
Good point.
And where they don't. And so I think writers bring that.
You know, in several of the essays and reviews about writers in particular, their works and their biographies, you talk about the relationship of the author's life to her fiction, Clarice Lispector, Eudora Welty, fantastic essay. Why do readers insist on finding these parallels, you think, looking for them?
The biographers do that.
They do.
So I was reviewing biographies in both those cases. I mean, the biographers are just often stuck with that, and they read the fiction backward. They read it looking for the life mm-hmm. instead of looking at the life, how it went into the fiction. They see the fiction going back into the life. It's an occupational hazard of biography that is never avoided. Mm-hmm. And so I just, in my essays on Welty and Lispector and also Millay, I was just reporting basically from what the biographers did. I did register a complaint, I think, in all three cases mm-hmm. about this reading backward thing.
Yeah.
Especially in the Welty and Millay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And expectations from Welty about what she would write about and what she would cover and all of that. Yeah.
There were some bad things in that bio, I think.
Do you find that, as you pointed out, do you find that a lot of readers try to look for writers in their fiction? I mean, this seems to be the case, right? I mean, perhaps the same that we might have this experience we might have at the movie theater where we sort of look for actors in their roles. Do you feel like readers look for writers in their fiction?
Do you think people look for actors in their movies?
You know what?
Movies?
I think people get to a point, especially people that are movie stars, that are in a lot of movies, they start to feel like they know them in some way, shape, or form, or they have some sense of familiarity or something like that. I think that crops up for a lot of people.
I think that's what perhaps brings them to the seat, mm-hmm. and they want to watch the film. But I think they're looking for the actor to be different from what they were. That's what I always assume.
I think they do in the theater, but I think in movies, we like to know that it's Harrison Ford, you know, saving this plane.
Oh,
Harrison Ford
oh,
finding this thing
oh,
in the dirt. You
yeah.
know, I don't know. But
yeah.
but about writers, what do you think?
Well, I do think people are often seeking the author in a book,
yeah.
often because they don't know the author at all,
mm-hmm.
and so they're seeking the author. I never read that way. At least I don't think I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, you know, I can't recommend reading that way. I won't say I'm opposed to reading that way. If someone's reading that way, that's just the way they read, and mm-hmm. it's not to be judged, I suppose. But it's also not what the author is hoping. The author isn't writing a book in order to be discovered.
Right.
The author is writing a book because the author wants to create this beautiful narrative object,
mm-hmm.
and the author wants the book to suffice.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't want to be sought past that book.
Yeah. It's one of the benefits of being a writer, right? You get to...
Yeah, that's right.
You have a few pieces in the book that are about politics, but very few. Do you feel like you avoid that topic intentionally, or it just isn't a sweet spot for you, or...?
Oh, I don't avoid it. I don't think people... I mean, I'm happy to yak and yak about politics.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people really want to hear me mm-hmm. on the subject. I did write several pieces on Hillary Clinton that I did not include here. And I say that at the end because I have a final piece on Hillary after the 2016 election. And because I felt they were, as I said, OBE, overturned by events.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a little hard on her.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even this one is hard on her because we're all kind of a little annoyed. But I did vote for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt she had some real... I mean, I was kind of a one-issue voter. I was a gun control voter.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted gun control, and she was the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I liked Bernie Sanders, but he wasn't strong on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so writing about politics is something I can do, but people don't necessarily want to hear from me.
Well, and gun control is something that certainly seems like it'll be coming up in the next cycle here with
I
the
hope.
Students from Parkland.
I hope those students are great. They are, you know,
yeah.
I hope.
What made you want to write about your wedding and marriage?
That piece was commissioned by someone, by a magazine that doesn't exist anymore, and I've already forgotten its name. Mm-hmm. And but even before the magazine went out of business, they killed the article.
They killed
that essay. It's one of my few personal essays, and so it's one of the few pieces in the book that has never appeared before anywhere. And so, and my agent thought it was a little depressing. She said, let's just take the kill fee and set this aside. But I don't know. I thought it was amusing. I went back. But it's a kind of combination of amusing and depressing. But the fact that the 60 Minutes crew was there when I got married.
It's tremendous.
I just couldn't resist it.
And they were willing to use you as their stand-in.
Yes, they were.
I've been speaking with Lori Moore about her new book, See What Can Be Done, Essays, Criticism, and Commentary. Tonight at 8, she will be in conversation with Julian Barnes, the 92nd Street Y. That's 1395 Lexington Avenue. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.